Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development of the House Joint Ways and Means. Welcome to President Durfer. We recognize him at the dais today. For the record, we have a full complement of members of the subcommittee. Representing the Legislative Fiscal Office is Dallas Wyan. Suki Huerta is our subcommittee assistant, and we are on a work session on Senate Bill 134. We'll go ahead and open the work session, and I'm going to ask Dallas to explain where we're at on the on 134.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 134, you may not be aware, is a PERS bill. The PERS, it makes a number of amendments to the existing public employees retirement system. It changes the membership of the board. It gives legislative direction as the board should give equal consideration whenever possible to the concerns of employers as well as employees within its fiduciary responsibility to the beneficiaries of the trust. It sets standard for funding of reserves and allows retirees to make lump sum withdrawals of theirs and the employer's share. It also allows local governments to join the state pool that's an amendment we're going to discuss. It also requires employers' participation as a variable annuity in the variable account so that if they don't get hit with the unequal reserve requirement when those employees who have had their funds in the variable withdraw or put it into the benefits and force reserve. Allows crediting of interest earnings to a requires or set standards for putting monies in a contingency reserves. It allows local governments that don't already have the authority to issue bonds to fund their unfunded liability, and it makes some other technical adjustments. We have before us for consideration a Dash A41 amendment that came from Senator Beyer's committee.
Senator Beyer, welcome. We'll go ahead and hear testimony from Senator Beyer. Roger Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer, State Senator, District 15, here again on Senate Bill 134, and urging adoption of the A41 amendments to Senate Bill 134. These amendments make technical corrections to the bill that when the bill left the Business Committee in the Senate, we thought we had done this, but after the bill left and was reprinted and the lawyers and the technical people started looking at it, they realized that the bill wasn't technically correct to fund the contingency reserve as we had envisioned, and these amendments simply make those technical corrections that fund the contingency reserve as it was envisioned when the bill left my committee. That is simply what they do. I would be happy to answer any questions anyone might have on the bill or on the A41 amendments.
Questions for Senator Beyer? Questions relative to the bill or to the technical corrections to fund the contingency reserve?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Senator Beyer. Representative Patridge now moves to the A41 amendments to Senate Bill 134. Are there any objections for the discussion? Seeing none, so ordered. We will incorporate the A41. Representative Patridge.
Mr. Chair, I'd move Senate Bill 134.
Did you have an issue regarding
with the A engrossed? After I do the motion, can I do that?
Yeah, you're welcome to do
134
that.
With the as amended to.
We would like to do just. I thought you had the community college issue first.
I can do that first.
Can we do that first? And
okay.
Then, and then we will. I'm going to ask for a representative to come forward to. Spokesperson on behalf of the PERS Coalition as well. So you had an issue there.
Okay, just real briefly, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am concerned about what's been done with the community college budget in terms of the fact that we cut them in regard to the PERS reduction rate, but by the same time, by this bill, we're taking out the pooling provision, so that'll be a net loss of about $2 million to community colleges. I know the governor had in his budget some enhancements, I believe there's enhancements in the co-chair's budget, but it's still a $2 million cut. From where they currently are, I'm prepared to vote this bill out, and because I think it's a good bill generally, but I would like that issue at least addressed either through the budgeting process to hold the community colleges harmless, because I think they're going to continue to play a vital role in our local communities, either in the budgeting process for the community colleges, because I know that that is going to be heard again, or amendments that I'm not familiar, as familiar with all the technical pieces of this as the good Senate president and others are. But I would certainly, I just wanted to express that issue on the record, but I am prepared to move the bill forward.
Thank you very much, Representative Patridge. I would like to just make certain that we understand the potential weight of the cut through community college and how that cut is effectuated by opting into the additional program here for the consolidated program.
If I may, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you have a new fiscal impact with your dash A41, which essentially addresses this effect of the pooling. We had testimony from Curtis Management that says with the A41, although pooling would take place immediately or effective July 1st of this year, any change in the rates wouldn't take place until July 1 of 2002. So the reduction would be postponed a year, so it would only have a half of the impact. If PERS board chooses to implement the rate in 2002, it may wait and defer.
So it could still have an effect. It still has an effect, but Mr. Chair, it still has an effect on the community colleges. I hope we can, at minimum, hold them harmless and look at the pooling question. I think a lot of people have put a lot of work into this bill, and I'm not willing to stand it up, at least at this point. We have other ways to help our community colleges.
Thank you, Representative Patridge. I appreciate that insight into that. We'd like to go ahead, and even though this is a work session, I'd like to go ahead and have a spokesperson representing the PERS coalition. I understand Attorney Greg Hartman is prepared to do that.
Good morning, Chairman. Members of the committee. First of all, thank you for letting me have the opportunity to talk a little bit about the bill. There's much in this bill that the PERS Coalition supports because we think it would be good for the PERS system. Basically, everything in the latter half of the bill, and by that I mean from Section 7 backwards, Section 8 and back, are all things which we think are very good for the system. They range over a variety of things, ranging from pooling to employer and variable to some changes in accounting systems within PERS. Now, much of this work has already been done by PERS, but I think it's very, very important that the legislature basically approve, in essence, by passing this portion of the bill, what the PERS system has done, because the PERS system itself has taken some very positive steps to deal with some issues which were of concern, particularly to local jurisdictions. We've supported those steps at the PERS level. We support the bill to the extent it deals with those issues. And I would note that all of that language essentially came from PERS. It's language which was given to you by the PERS system to basically make some changes which would be very positive. It's the first part of the bill where we have some problems. And let me talk about two parts, first of all, Sections 1 through 3 and Section 5. And to give you some understanding of where those sections come from, they were part of a package of amendments which were offered to the Senate subcommittee from the representatives who are representing local jurisdictions in the litigation which is currently going on in Marion County Circuit Court. And I assume all of you are generally aware of the fact that we have some litigation going on in which local jurisdictions are challenging, in some cases, interpretations of PERS statutes that go back 40 or 50 years. They introduced what I would charitably describe as the wish list of what they would like to get out of that lawsuit. They introduced that as amendments to this bill. Over the course of time, I think primarily because of testimony both by legislative counsel as well as the Attorney General's office, most of those concepts were taken out of the bill because they simply were things that would change the current system, which frankly would cause contract breach issues and so forth and so on. There are two things which have survived to this point. The first is Sections 1 through 3, which is the section which started out as a dual fiduciary concept. When this amendment was introduced, it basically said that the PERS board would treat employees and employers as if they had a fiduciary obligation to both. Well, The AG quickly said, you can't do that. You can't serve two masters, essentially. The notion of fiduciary obligation is one that runs solely to the individual members. The problem is, instead of simply deleting this, we now have language which, frankly, I don't think anyone can understand. I can't understand it. I have talked to my colleagues in the AG's office and the Legislative Council office to ask them what they think this language means. And frankly, I'm not sure any of us can agree. And the problem I see with that is eventually what will happen is this is going to cause disputes at the purse level. It will also ultimately cause litigation because everyone's going to be arguing what this language means. It's badly drafted, not because I think Dave Hendricks doesn't know how to draft bills. He knows very well how to draft them, but he was trying to incorporate a concept here, which is really not a concept which is going to be helpful to the purse system. I would strongly urge you to consider simply deleting that section of the bill. It will not improve the system. It will not do anything good. And quite frankly, I think all it will do is cause turmoil with the system. And as I said, eventually I think it will lead to litigation. Section 5 and 6 both relate to the contingency reserve. By way of background, the contingency reserve statute was first put into the system in 1949. At that time, the legislature had a very valid concern about the liquidity of the purse system. It's hard for us to imagine a system of the size we now think of as purse as having a liquidity problem, but back in 1949, when purse recommended this statute to the legislature, there was a total of $30,000 in the employee reserve for retirement benefits. There was a very serious concern that they're going to run out of money. And if you look at the current statute, which has remained unchanged for the last 52 years, it basically says if there's a deficit of monies, that's what we're dealing with. We're setting aside some money to deal with the deficit of monies. That statute has remained unchanged for 52 years. When the amendment was introduced by the local jurisdictions regarding the contingency reserve, they were really trying to accomplish something very different, because what the original language of the amendment that was presented to the Senate subcommittee did was to change the funding of PERSE in some ways by using the contingency reserve as a mechanism for basically relieving employers of some of the burden of funding the system. The Attorney General testified that you couldn't do that, that that would be a breach of contract. And what we have left here is some rather odd language which basically creates a contingency reserve when, frankly, none is needed. For instance, I think one of the topics they touch on in the contingency reserve is extraordinary attorney's fees. We're talking about a $40 billion system. I don't think there'll ever be extraordinary attorney's fees to the level that we would need a separately funded reserve to deal with that issue. It's a proper charge on the system. Nobody disputes that. But what we're doing is, and I said this when this issue came up before the PERSE board, we really have basically a solution in search of a problem. There is no problem here which can be addressed by the contingency reserve. What has happened is the original concept, which was introduced by the local jurisdictions, has left the bill because the Attorney General says you can't go there. And what is left is this curious hybrid of ideas that, frankly, once again, are not going to be helpful to the system. It's not going to make it a better system. I will predict to you that in 2 years, the local jurisdictions will be back complaining about this contingency language because it does not accomplish what they want. It will simply be, again, a source of controversy at the PERSE level, potentially another source of litigation. The PERSE coalition does not want to see any more litigation at the PERSE level. I mean, we want a system which is solid and where we don't have these kinds of problems. The last two that I want to address, and I'm only going to touch on the composition of the board, to say that I think there's a perception perhaps that the board has far more authority in running the system than it really does. Basically, the system runs because the legislature has created a system which runs in a certain fashion. The PERSE board really has little discretion in how they run that system. There really aren't very many times when they are exercising discretion, and it's really only then that the issue of who is on that PERSE board really, frankly, makes any difference at all. Right now, we have four representatives from labor. they don't go up there and vote a labor agenda. They're really representatives. They're a way of having a communication back and forth between the people who primarily are the beneficiaries of the system and the people who are running the system. We support the board in its current fashion. We really don't think any case has been made to change the board. Finally, there's one other section of the bill, and this perhaps is in a sense the most controversial, and that's the one that has to do with the gain loss reserve. And I have to give you just a moment of history to kind of explain how we got to where we are today. In the early 70s, the legislature passed a statute which basically guaranteed for what we now call Tier 1 employees that each year they would receive no less than what the assumption the system made on earnings was for that year. Currently, that's 8%, often referred to these days as the 8% guarantee, because Tier 1 members are guaranteed an 8% return on their investment if they're in the regular account every year. That guarantee has been funded initially by a deficit reserve, and then since 1979 by this gain loss reserve. As a result of that funding vehicle, in other words, the way PERS has handled this, that guarantee has not cost employers or taxpayers a single penny. That guarantee has been fully funded by excess earnings from the employees themselves. We have no dispute with that. We have no argument to make with that. But I have to start with that background. The PERS system, as we sit here today, has been successful in handling that problem without any call on taxpayers or employers to fund that guarantee at all. Now, early in this session, the PERS system, I can't even call it a study, they did a model, which, frankly, we were one of the major proponents of the PERS system doing that modeling because we felt they needed to have a much more sophisticated analysis on this issue than they had been making to that point. That single model showed a potential $7 billion deficit. And I know that caused quite a ripple through this building because I was down here talking to people. What you have to understand is that was not a modeling of the gain loss reserve. It was a modeling of the wind down of the Tier 1 system over the next 40 years or so. And unfortunately, while it counted all of the obligations that would accrue over the next 40 years, it did not balance that by counting all of the assets which are available to meet those. And most specifically, what it left out was excess earnings on the retiree reserve, which for many years has been part of what has supported payouts of the system. So to the extent that there is a concern raised because of this, you have to understand it was not a study of the gain loss system itself. Secondarily, it was a single model. What the PERS system intends to do is to model many assumptions so that we can learn and understand how gain loss will function in a wind down of the Tier 1 system. We don't know the answers to that as yet. And so in a sense, this language is premature simply because we don't know all of the policy issues which may arise as we go down the road and think about how that works. Now, the current language started out as what I would call a policy statement, simply saying that it is the goal of the system that that gain loss should be at zero when the last Tier 1 member departs 40 years from now or thereabouts. During the course of the hearings, the word positive balance was inserted in the language. I don't know what positive balance means. I don't know whether it means a dollar. I don't know whether it means $1 million. I don't know whether it means $100 million. At a minimum, as you approach this problem, I would strongly urge you to go back to the original language that talks about moving to a zero balance. Because if you leave the word positive in there, no one knows what that means. Again, that's subject to dispute. But I think there's a broader problem. And again, I think the legislature is simply a little bit premature in addressing this issue because we don't know all the policy problems which will arise. And let me give you an example. One of the concerns that we have as the individuals who represent the beneficiaries of the system is we're comfortable, first of all, with a system that winds down to zero. We're not looking for this to be some kind of bonus or extra payment to employees. But we're also concerned with how we get there, because we know that to the extent that you fund the gain loss today, You are taking money that was earned by today's participants and setting it aside potentially for tomorrow's participants or people who will participate in the system over the next 40 years. We're very concerned about equity issues, what we've called generational equity between those groups. If we overfund the gain loss reserve, for instance, we may well take money earned by today's group of people who are close to retirement, push it into the future, and create what really would be an unintended bonus for those people who retire in the future. Similarly, if we underfund the gain loss reserve today, we have exactly the opposite problem. So we are, as the PERS Coalition, we are very interested in addressing this problem. As a matter of fact, as I indicated, we have been one of the motivators that the PERS system was saying, let's study this problem and make sure we get it right. It is a very important issue. But what we fear is the legislature is simply moving too quickly, and by setting a single goal, even if you go back to the original language of the amendment to say that the attempt here is to reach a zero balance, you are really saying that that is the primary legislative goal. There's no question, I don't think there's any question, that it is an appropriate goal, but there should be other goals to be considered in the process of the wind down of the system. So we would suggest to you it's simply premature to act on that, and you really should not be terribly concerned about that $7 billion, because that, obviously a huge number and an item of huge concern, but was not a modeling of the gain loss reserve system. It was really a different kind of study. PERS is committed to studying this issue. I can tell you at their retreat they talked about the process of going forward and studying this, and I would suggest that this is an issue that may well be deferred to a time when we have a much fuller understanding of how this is going to work, and the legislature would be much better able at that time to construct a set of goals that would basically instruct the PERS system on how to wind this down in a fashion which would be responsible to all concerned, and of course consistent with their obligations to the beneficiaries of the system. We have drafted the Dash 38 amendments. We have not introduced those or asked that those be introduced at this point. Those basically simply eliminate the first seven sections of this bill. We would strongly urge you to consider that as an appropriate way to deal with the bill. It would allow all of the additional material that everyone supports, local jurisdictions, First Coalition, to remain in the bill, all of which I think would be positive for the system. So, happy to answer any questions if anybody has any questions about our position.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hartman. And please recognize that this is a Ways and Means Subcommittee, and we'll deal with as much as we possibly can the fiscal issues. I would like to have Senator Durfer, President Durfer, if you would make any kind of response that would be necessary at this time relative to those fiscal issues, which Mr. Hartman may have raised.
Well, just a couple comments, Chair, for me. First of all, you said that the model showed we were $7 billion short. As I recall, the report, it said $7 to $13 billion short, not just $7 billion. So you need to really put all the facts before us. By shorting that, for me, you lose credibility when you say those kind of things.
I can respond if you care to have me respond. I'd be happy to.
Well, please proceed, President.
Then you said that we don't need to change the board because, and I would point out to you, the board has had opportunities to make changes in the system. As an example, a few years ago, when we had a system that didn't allow the employer to pay the same percentage or invest in the same way the employee did, and that was a real mistake. The board could have changed that at any time, and they didn't change it until they knew it was going to happen in the legislature. At that point, they changed it. Well, I would point out to you that the board had ample opportunity to make changes. They chose not to do that. So I think that the board does need to be changed in that respect so that people who are familiar with pension systems make sure that it is a safe system. Another point, you said that the 8% guarantee, personally, when I look, I got a letter from just a recent employee. And what they told me that the present employees got an 8% return. She got a 0.54 return on her investment in PERS. I wouldn't call that a very balanced system. If I were a new employee, I would be concerned about having a system that was going to pay me a retirement at the end of the Tier 1. And I would point out to you that when you say a positive, a balance means less than, means more than zero. It doesn't necessarily mean, it just means that you can't have a negative balance. And if it's $1, whatever it takes, that would be a positive balance on it. So I'm not looking at this to try to harm PERS people. What I'm looking at is to make it a system that is viable so that future employees will have a retirement system. From my viewpoint, if you look at what's going to happen over the next 27 years, the people in the state system will be retiring, and the figures that I have had, anywhere from 75 to 100% of their current salaries. You cannot sustain a system paying those kind of retirement payments. I know we have a big amount of dollars now, $40 billion. That will disappear, and the future employees will not have a retirement system. So I think it is important that the legislature does get involved in this and start making some corrections in the system so that it does remain a viable system. When you say that taxpayers have never been asked to contribute, when I get a letter from EWEB saying that they're now going to be paying, including the 6% pickup, 28% of the payroll for the retirement system, that's a problem. When you start adding Social Security to that, you know, when 35-36% of your payroll goes to retirement, that those are taxpayer dollars that are being paid. So those are kind of points that I would make, that I think that the system does need to be addressed and there does need to be some corrections.
Thank you very much, President Durr, for...
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hartman. Colleagues, I do want to point out that in the interim, there's been a great deal of task force work that has gone on. President Durfer has made this a tireless interim attempt to work, I think, bilaterally with all of the parties. This hasn't been a unilateral effort. We do have a Dash A engrossed bill, which is before us here, in which both Senator Durfer has spent investing a good deal of time and energy, and which another substantive committee has had opportunities to hear. I'd like to this time just go ahead and have Dallas from Legislative Fiscal explain any further fiscal impacts that this would have on the state and local budgets and agencies. I know that this is a new iteration of the previous report, which we had on the 28th of May. Dallas, can you just bring me up to date on that?
Briefly, Mr. Chairman, the committee, there's potential effect on PERS expenditures and need for FTE. I would propose no adjustment to its budget at this time, pending ultimate resolution of whatever the bill as it comes out. PERS can then come back to the emergency board and seek the additional FTE and expenditure limitations. So with respect to the operating budget of PERS, we don't see an adjustment as being needed because of this bill right now. They can come back in September to the emergency board. We have before you the analysis from the PERS actuary as to the potential benefits and costs for the future, and those, again, are all subject to subsequent review of the actuarial data. I have no other comments.
Thank you very much, and we do recognize that the emergency board in the interim is available for PERS to return to get the expenditure limitation to proceed with the additional costs which you've identified. These are all other funds being collected through the PERS. That's my understanding. Further questions of Legislative Fiscal Office, Representative Patridge?
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 134A, as amended with the Dash 41 amendments by this committee, to the full committee with the due pass recommendation.
You've heard the recommendation of Representative Patridge. Is there any discussion relative to the comment? Yes, Representative Smith is recognized.
Just a quick comment, Chairman Butler. I'm going to vote yes on this today to get this out of committee, but I'm going to reserve my vote for the floor until I learn more about the issue. But I will be voting yes today.
Thank you very much. Further discussion? Representative Johnson is recognized.
I'll be recorded as a no.
Okay. Representative Johnson is recorded as a no vote. Any further discussion? Other dissenting votes?
Mr. Chair, are you going to do a roll call vote?
We can go ahead and do a roll call vote. Let's go ahead and do that this time. Suki, would you like to make a roll call vote, please? Those wishing to vote in favor of the Representative Patrick's motion to pass the full committee with a due pass recommendation, please vote aye. Those in the negative, nay, please.
Senator Yee?
Aye.
Senator Cardinal?
Aye.
Representative Patrick?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
No.
Representative Ringo?
No.
Representative Smith?
You can leave the tape off. I am an aye vote.
Aye, and you have.
Aye.
Thank you very much. With that vote, we will declare the motion passing, and we will go ahead then and take this to the full. Are you and Ego?
Yes. But you can get me there if you need me to call.
Representative Patrick.
Oh, just that. I need to go too.
Yeah, he said that you got a work session coming up. Good morning again. I probably said good afternoon on the prior round. This feels like afternoon. It gets longer and longer. This is a public hearing on Senate Bill 740 relating to the International Fuels Tax Treaty Agreement, the IFTA. And I'll buy that acronym if that's okay. So
that's a two-bucker.
That's two-bucker.
Yeah, okay. All right. You got it. So let's go ahead and Susie Jordan represents our legislative fiscal office, and again, Susie Huerta is our assistant.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 740 has been referred to Ways and Means from the Senate Revenue Committee. The bill authorizes the Department of Transportation to establish by rule a fee to be paid by trucking companies to recover costs for participating in the International Fuel Tax Agreement. I have placed at your seat a memo explaining the process by which they would develop those fees, and the fiscal impact and the revenue impact statement that were issued are attached. And you do have people in the audience who wish to speak to this bill. So I will defer to the public.
Thank you very much. We'll go ahead then with public testimony on this bill. We'll start with, let's see, we have three folks that are signed up. Earl Fultz and Bob Russell. Mr. Fultz.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Earl Foltz. I'm a one-truck owner-operator. I have a self-loading log truck, and I occasionally run into Washington. This is a bill that needs to pass in some form, or we don't have IFTA. But I've given you copies of what I've proposed as an amendment to it. It's been looked at by a number of folks, but they keep passing the cost of this down to the one-truck operator so that the large companies can run for pretty much free, and we can't afford it. I've proposed that you set the fee per truck. Each truck that crosses the border gets to pay a fee for the benefit of crossing the border and receives the benefit of being able to. I've also included a line that would set the reporting period for trucking companies based on the IFTA miles. At this point, even if you only cross the border once in a year, you have to report at least every quarter, and possibly every month, even though there's no money to report because ODOT has decided to include the Oregon miles as part of IFTA for figuring the schedule for reporting. That's the only time they use Oregon miles. I've also put in a line that would sunset this at the point when a fuel tax is incorporated into Oregon's laws, if we ever do. Because at that point, it could be the money from the fuel tax could be used to cover the administrative cost as it is in every other state and as it is in our weight mile system. On the trucks crossing the per truck fee, ODOT has proposed to charge a person, a one truck operator, $250 a year just to get an IFTA sticker to be able to cross the border. My last fuel tax report, which would have been the first quarter of this year, was for a little over $10. Unless I cross the border between now and the end of this month, my fuel tax for this month, this quarter, will be zero. You add it all up, in order to pay somewhere between that 10 and maybe at the most a couple hundred dollars, if I was to run a lot of Washington the rest of the year, I'll have to pay $250 just to buy the sticker. A truck based in Washington does it for free. They have no cost to get an extra sticker. Most of the states either have no cost or very minimal charge for the sticker. ODOT will tell you they need $1.3 million to run this program, and that if they charge a fee per truck, the large companies will move their trucks out of the state, or at least base them in another state. I've kind of thought some about that, and I can't see the real problem with their doing their IFTA through another state if they decide they don't want to participate in our program. The trucks will still be parked here in Oregon. The routes that they run, the loads they haul will still be hauled exactly as it is now. The only difference is they'll base that truck somewhere else on paper. So that means that Oregon will still receive exactly the same amount of money. They'll get the same money from weight mile that they would have gotten otherwise. They'll get the same money from the prorate registration that they would have gotten otherwise. The problem is that ODOT will not have to deal with the paperwork to handle that. They'll just get the money sent to them instead of having to deal with paperwork. And I don't see that as a problem. It's merely less state employees and less work for them to receive the same amount. If we went with a per truck fee based on ODOT needing $1.3 million and the number of trucks that they think are under the IFTA system right now, it would be approximately $25 per truck to get an IFTA sticker. And while I think that's a little bit expensive, I'd still much rather see a per truck fee so that everybody pays their own fair share. If you have any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Fultz. Representative Johnson is recognized.
A couple. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Fultz. The first question that I have is, you said ODOT has proposed a $250 a year fee just to get the IFTA sticker. My understanding was that the fees were going to be set in rule with a public process that would accompany it. How at this point do you know that the fee is $250?
A letter from ODOT dated April 17th to the Senate General Government and Transportation Committee.
Mr. Chair, I'd like the opportunity to ask ODOT to respond to that.
We do have...
Well, and how fortuitous. Ms. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kelly Taylor with the Department of Transportation. I'm here for Greg DelPonte today. He had a conflict and couldn't be here. What we included in our testimony, and I have it here, and I'll give you a copy of the testimony for you, is simply one proposal. I mean, we were asked, what could this look like? And in the bill, it is as Representative Johnson has said, Mr. Chair, it's a rulemaking process that will include the public, that will include the industry, and it could go per truck, it could go a set fee. I mean, it's simply rulemaking authority. And the reason we must have this bill is because the Attorney General in their review has said that the fuel tax agreement program cannot be covered under highway funds. It must be paid for by the fees we collect. And so we're sort of stuck. We kind of only have two choices. Either the program pays for itself through its fees, or we don't have IFTA. And if we don't have IFTA, I'll let Mr. Russell talk to that because he answered it for another committee. It's a big problem for the trucks because they have no other way than to pay their taxes to the other state. The states don't let you pay directly to them. They make you go through another state.
That's a perfect segue into my follow-up question.
Follow-up for Jim Johnson.
In Mr. Fultz's testimony, he seemed to indicate that there might be a mechanism that he's contemplated that would have other states ostensibly doing Oregon's work and just sending us the money. On the face of it, Mr. Fultz, respectfully, that seems a little unrealistic. I'm sure that as a legislator, I would be very concerned were Oregon performing California's work and just sending them the check. I'd like Ms. Taylor to respond to the concept that you raised at the end of your testimony.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, you mean the one about another state collecting our wet mile?
Correct.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, I don't believe that will happen. I don't believe the other states will be willing to do that for us. I will say that there is one other option, however, other than belonging to IFTA. A small company such as Mr. Fultz, if they choose not to belong to IFTA, they don't have to. If you're making lots of trips and paying a lot of tax, it's a good thing to do. If you're only making infrequent trips, you may buy a trip permit from that other state in order to go in and out of that state on that trip. So someone who only makes, like he's saying, one or two trips, I think it might be more economical for them to buy a trip permit from that state.
What's the cost of a trip permit?
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, the states vary, but for Washington, I believe it's just $20.
I'm trying to get a sense of the scope. $250, and I recognize that that's a proposal, versus $20 a trip for infrequent trips. Do I have the numbers for, right?
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, I believe that that is what Washington would charge if you did not belong to their IFTA and just needed an occasional trip over their border.
One more follow-up.
Follow-up, Representative Johnson.
By way of regulatory burden on small trucking companies, where, if I were in Mr. Fultz's situation, where would I procure a trip permit? How could that be done so that it wasn't bureaucratically burdensome on me?
I'm going to defer to
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Russell. I'm Director of Government Affairs for the Oregon Trucking Association. There's a variety of ways to obtain them. You can get them at truck stops. You can actually get them faxed to your office.
Our home.
And charge it on a credit card. So it's not inconvenient to get them.
Further questions from Mr. Fultz? Thank you very much, Mr. Fultz. And then, Bob, you are next on the list. So,
again, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bob Russell, Director of Government Affairs for the Oregon Trucking Association. Like Mr. Fultz, we don't like this bill. However, I'm here to support this bill. we find ourselves between a rock and a hard spot here. And as a result of the Attorney General's letter of counsel that you're all familiar with, they cannot, ODOT cannot use highway funds to fund this program because there are no tax revenues that accrue to the state of Oregon. And as a result of that, the fees need to be set to cover the full cost of the program. And correct, Kelly was correct in that what the bill does is it allows ODOT to do it by administrative rule. Mr. Foltz has testified at previous hearings, and ODOT has indicated that they would take his concerns into consideration in the rulemaking process. So I think this is as good as it gets. If we don't pass this particular bill and Oregon no longer is able to participate in IFTA, then Oregon no longer has an interstate trucking industry. And that simply is unacceptable. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Mr. Russell? I just had one question for Mr. Russell. We've got some information about the letter that Kelly will be handing out, but it's, I think, alluded to, on the bill, the face of the bill indicates that maximum limits the maximum fee to $650. And based upon the testimony of Mr. Foltz, if a single owner operator is at $250 and the bill limits the upper limit at $650, is $650 reasonable? Recognizing that there's over 3,000 of the small operators in the state, and there's just a handful, maybe 50 or so, that would operate over 50 trucks.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I believe that it is reasonable. And the point that Mr. Foltz was making earlier is that companies can go to other states to pay their IFTA. And it's a legitimate thing that they can do under the International Fuel Tax Agreement plan. All you have to do is you have to have an office and a telephone, and that can be, then become your base state. One of the concerns is that if we get the fee too high on the large companies, they are in fact going to move. If they move, then it requires raising the fee on the smaller company. So we don't want to encourage the large companies to move, because that increases the burden on the little guys like Mr. Foltz. So by setting the maximum limit at $650, my members indicate that they will not go out of state. They will stay here in Oregon, and they will pay a much higher fee than Mr. Foltz will pay. But that will protect Mr. Foltz for the future, and ODOT will not have to increase his fee because the population, the number of carriers, goes down because the big guys move out of state.
So that's a price per fleet, not per truck.
That's correct.
Okay. Further questions of Mr. Russell? Senator Parnell.
I don't have any question. I'd just like to comment that I think you see in your information that all yeses out of the Senate revenue, and then I was on the Public Affairs Committee that had adequate input, as we've had this morning, from this as well. So it has gone through three processes, which would be comforting and no labels.
Okay. Thank you. Kelly?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, basically I gave you my testimony in a nutshell. I won't take any more of your time.
Are there any other questions of Kelly? Thank you very much. We will now move to a work session on Senate Bill 740 as they engross. Discussion. Representative Jackson?
I was wondering if the chair were ready to entertain a motion.
I will entertain the motion.
I would move Senate Bill 740A to full Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
You've heard the motion. Is there any discussion relative to the motion? Any questions? Are there any objections to the motion? Seeing and hearing none, so ordered. We will go ahead and have that go to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Representative Johnson?
Mr. Chair, just by way of assurance for Mr. Foltz, I wouldn't mind having Ms. Taylor and or an ODOT representative on the record saying that in the rulemaking process, Mr. Foltz's concerns will have an equal opportunity to come to the table with the big guys. I don't want to leave Mr. Foltz leaving this committee completely shut out of an opportunity to raise his concerns during rulemaking, and I just would like for his as a courtesy to him to have it on the record that he'll, his concerns will be considered in rule writing.
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, Kelly Taylor again with ODOT. I definitely give you that word. We've said that all along, be it Mr. Foltz or any of the other small operators. We want the public hearings and the process to be inclusive of all concerns and to try to make it the best program we can and the best balance we can.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And Mr. Chair, I'd just like to say I did hear Kelly say that in the Public Affairs Committee. I wasn't in the Revenue Committee, but I think we want to be sure it's clear that, it, as you stated, Kelly, that it is Mr. Foltz and other folks like Mr. Foltz that have.
I would like to know that those meetings will be held throughout the state when the public hearings are actually heard or the status there.
Mr. Chair, I don't know what the plan is, but I will certainly carry that forth and see what we can do to accommodate
Thank
that.
Thank you very much, Kelly. I appreciate
Thank you.
It. With that, we'll go ahead and assign a carrier to the full. Senator Parner, you've heard this a couple of times.
Yes, twice now.
Okay.
Okay, I'm in.
Okay.
Yeah.
Senator Yee, would you like to carry it to the Senate? Okay, Senator Parner to the Senate.
To
the House. Representative Johnson to the House. Okay. Thank you very much. We will then close the further any further hearing on Senate Bill 740, and we will then open a public hearing on 3075.
Well,
nobody here to
call.
Oh, 3075. We have signed up to speak Mr. Warner, Bruce Warner, the Director of the Department of Transportation.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. A pleasure to be here. I think my testimony is being handed out as we speak here. Very quickly, House Bill 3075 requires the Oregon Department of Transportation to use $25 million of state highway funds in the 2001-2003 biennium to match local dollars for projects on the state highway system. And while we very much appreciate the efforts of the sponsor to help provide additional resources for state highways, I wanted to point out that this, since this bill has no new resources attached with it, this bill could change the geographic allocation of transportation dollars and require breaking current commitments that came about through the Oregon's current public process for project selection. And these are very similar to the comments that I made to the House Transportation Committee a month or two ago. In terms of the discussion, I think it's important to note that there are some issues that this committee needs to consider when they deliberate on this bill. First off, that things that I think we're a bit worried about is specific local governments in high growth and high revenue areas are more likely to be able to generate the dollars that would be matched by the dollars identified in this House bill. Since the dollars are set aside from a statewide source, dollars are likely to shift towards these areas, in other words, the areas who are actually able to afford the matches, and away from the areas that are not economically positioned to generate large amounts of local money for match on a project like this. So in other words, you will have and have-nots, and the haves will, again, be able to take advantage of this, and the have-nots will probably not be able to take advantage of it. I think the more importantly, in the very last paragraph under the discussion, I was reminded, as my staff was, by the chair of the House Transportation Committee that current law requires the Oregon Transportation Commission to favor projects with local funds involved. And this, I believe, has already resulted in advancing a number of projects in the statewide transportation program while still complying with Oregon's process of public involvement in project selection. So in summary, what I would like to submit to you is that the Oregon Transportation Commission remains committed to working with local governments and the area commissions on transportation in the project selection process, and we believe that avenues exist in the process to give priority to projects that have local funding. So in other words, if a $10 million project was identified where $5 million was available by the local governments or private sector to move that project forward, and it again was a project that met the requirements of state and federal law, it's a project that we would really like to move forward and would give that a high priority. And for your information, on the back side of the testimony, I provided a copy of the ORS 366.507 entitled Modernization Program, Funding Conditions and Criteria, and under 4G in the second column, just outlined that priority to be given where there is local government or private sector financial participation. And it's very clear that we need to follow that law in our project selection. So again, I appreciate the bill sponsors' ideas here in terms of trying to get additional dollars for our state highway system. But again, I want to make sure you're aware of those issues as you do consider this bill. So that would conclude my comments, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Warner. And I'm sure there is some question, but I just wanted to make sure that you were aware that we had heard 2139, House Bill 2139. Do you anticipate that it would pass the Senate?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we are very hopeful that it will pass the Senate.
And we just heard 740, Senate Bill 740 today. Between those two bills, those will be raising about $40 million. You indicated there's no new sources of money?
Mr. Chairman, what I said is, as attached to this bill, there was no new sources of money.
Oh, attached to this bill. Okay, all right. I beg your pardon. Because I think that I can count for just about $70 or $80 million of new money that's been raised for the Highway Department, the Department of Transportation, this session, if these bills that we're looking at here, all of which I think have the blessing of the governor at this particular point, so if they proceed. So there is a lot of new money that we're talking about, so I just wanted to make sure that that was abundantly clear. And I was wondering, couple of those I'd like to see dead myself rather than that. Representative Ringo is recognized.
Well, thank you. I guess the members of the committee, I need to explain that this is my bill, and so I'd like the opportunity to give a little background and maybe touch on some of the points Mr. Warner raised. I think we're all familiar with instances of highway projects in our own areas that simply haven't been done. And you talk to local government officials, and they say, well, we've been talking to ODOT for years about this project on state roads, and for some reason or another, it just never happened, never got enough attention in ODOT to get done. And this bill is intended to allow a measure of local control. So if a local government comes up with half the money, ODOT will come up with the other half, and that project will get done. And this subcommittee heard the testimony of Representative Trudy Smith about 2 months ago. Well, she had a specific example in her district, and I don't remember the highway intersection, but they just couldn't seem to get it done. This would be that mechanism. Now, one of the concerns, and I've talked to Mr. Warner about this bill several times, trying to address some of his concerns. One of his concerns was that to the extent that we are invading funds that are part of the 2001-2003 STIP, then somebody's going to lose out. We're going to be messing up the current process, and that's going to cause a problem. Well, the answer to that is, if this $25 million is from separate funds, essentially new money in the system, then none of the current projects are going to lose out. And I think that's the key, and Representative Butler addressed that concern, where there is new money in the system. And I spoke with an ODOT person in the audience here who mentioned, well, that is one of the issues, and I raised the $400 million bonding. And I spoke with the Legislative Council office yesterday about this, about whether the, and I think that's House Bill 2142 is the number.
Right.
And the question was, could that bonding be considered some of the new money that would go into this $25 million fund? And she said, sure. And if you look at the definition of the highway fund in ORS 366, it includes bonding money. So Legislative Council's office is pretty certain, well, they are certain that the funds to be generated from that transportation package would go to make this. So I think that argument about it disrupting the STIP just doesn't go. The next argument about, well, the more wealthy counties are going to get most of the money, I've tried to address that by capping the amount to any one county at $5 million. You know, I come from Washington County, and maybe we would get $5 million, but frankly, if we have 500,000 people, and if Harney County or Malheur County were able to match at 100,000 or a couple hundred thousand, I think that would be fair. In some ways, I think this is an experiment because it's hard to know how the local counties and local governments will respond, whether they really will come up with matching funds and they'll want to participate. I think some will. I think some may not have their act together in terms of the engineering. But it is an experiment, and I think it gives the local control to governments that they haven't had. And I appreciate Director Warner's comments that, well, it's in the statute right now that they're supposed to give a high priority to where there's a local match. still, we all have examples in our areas where people just haven't been able to get projects done, even when they've waived money at ODOT. And so that's what this is intended to address.
Thank you, Representative Ringo. I would like to have you respond to that, and I recognize that you're new on the block, Director Warner, but there is a rather substantial amount of money that's new money through the fees that will be raised now, which will go back into the Highway Trust Fund, leave more money available to the Highway Trust Fund under 2139, and the additional monies under 2142, as well as those other monies which will be generated as a result of the Attorney General's opinion and by which vehicle and avenue we're striving to make sure that these monies are there. What could you respond to that and then try and encapsulate for us your primary objection to this type of legislation, this initiative?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'll attempt to answer that. First off, I believe that if there is additional money for projects, then much of the concern about, as you point out, Representative Ringo, about bumping projects out of the stiff goes away. In other words, with the additional dollars, then again, that is obviously allayed in a very large way. Obviously, this bill doesn't deal with that funding, so that's why I made the comment that I did.
Right, but you recognize for the record that there is now new money, which brings an enhanced ability then.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. When those bills are passed, there will be additional dollars to deal with the needs. In terms of the bill itself, and again, maybe I could ask, what I saw out on your table here was the -3 amendments, I guess, which again did place a number of additional sideboards and requirements on these projects, which I think are attempting to get at a number of the issues that Representative Ringo and I have talked about in the past. However, when I read some of those sideboards and restrictions on the use of this fund, I also think those may actually, quite frankly, hem us in terms of our ability to address some of the needs of local government and actually give us less flexibility to be able to work with local governments and business folks to be actually able to move projects forward that could be available with the monies that are from the new sources of revenue you've identified.
Have you been able to articulate that to Representative Ringo?
No, I have not, Mr. Chairman, because I just saw these amendments not more than a few moments ago.
Representative Johnson's recognized.
I was just, thank you, Mr. Chair, curious to have you respond to the question of whether or not local match, incentivizing local match, ultimately reduces cost. If you have a project that's waiting for 100% ODOT funding, and the local and the locals come up with a significant percentage of that, in trade for the locals coming up with a significant percentage, it gets accelerated to the top of the queue, but it has a net reduction in cost to ODOT. Why isn't that a good thing?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, that is a good thing. And what I'm attempting to say is under the current law and the way it's set up now, I think that is what has happened. They are essentially buying up the priority of their various local projects by agreeing to participate financially in those individual projects. And I think the ones where we've been unable to secure the other match is just that there's other higher priority projects around a particular region that have usually been identified by the region as a whole, not just one specific entity wanting their specific project.
So you're afraid,
Mr. Chair,
local jurisdictions come up with match, accelerate to the front of the line, that strips money away from projects that are already prioritized, perhaps regionally?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, that's correct, especially, but I think the caveat that we just talked about, without additional revenues, and I think that's the point.
And the additional revenues, I just want to make sure I understand that the additional $400 million in potential bonding would address that problem, so that eliminates that problem.
In many ways, that's correct.
Thank you. Representative Ringo, Representative Patridge.
I like generally the concept of the bill. I talked to Representative Ringo about that. I am concerned, though, about some of the things in the -3 amendments that we have. I'm concerned that I think if we're going to do these things and provide some leveraging, coming from a community and off a city council who raised fees over 100% on local taxpayers to come up with $15 million to do a match,
piece with the Oregon Department of Transportation for the South Medford interchange. I'm concerned about some of the particular pieces, especially on big projects like ours. We're matching some of the money now to pay for engineering and design work, which we would not have done alone had there not been some things on the match. I think also we should look at some kind of constraints based upon that the match could be those projects that draw. I know we've already had testimony on the STIP, and I know there's a lot of confusion about what's on the STIP, what's off the STIP, but I don't know how to ask ODOT to evaluate this much money without looking at the STIP, because there's been a lot of public process on that, though I agree that some things need to be improved, and I think that they are improving according to my local people that I'm talking to who are engaged in the process currently. And I was also concerned about, rather than by county, maybe for places like eastern and southern Oregon, rather than maybe Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington County eating up, and Marion County being able to eat up the whole $25 million relatively quickly, to look at either by area or region based upon what ODOT's currently doing. But, you know, I don't know if that would make ODOT feel any better about doing something like this.
President Rangel, do you want to respond to that?
Well, thanks, Mr. Chair. As I said earlier, it's hard to guess exactly how this would be implemented. And I put in the max of $5 million per county so that you don't have a problem talking about where, let's say, Beaverton came up with one $5 million project, Hillsborough came up with another, Washington County came up with another, because that's not what we want. We want to spread this around the state in a fair way. You could envision circumstances where a lot of the local rural areas would come up with modest matches, the big areas would come up with big projects, and it would come up to more than $25 million. Okay? I mean, let's say that everybody tries to throw in their proposal, and it comes up to $35 million. ODOT's going to have to figure out some priority system, and that's what it does in Section 6, specifies rules. So I don't think it's correct to assume automatically that the big counties, the populous counties, are going to get this money. I mean, it's very possible that ODOT's rule system would say, okay, fine, you've got all these little towns, Fossil's come up with their 100,000, and Condon and Happner, they've all got their little projects, and those are going to get priority. So I don't know how that would work. I've tried to figure out what are the best numbers so that it's spread out evenly. And Representative Smith has been whispering in my ear, what if you allocated $7.5 million to rural Oregon? I mean, that's something to consider. Maybe the other thing to do is to decrease the amount per county to $4 million so that you really try to spread it out. I think that's the goal, and I don't disagree with your comments that that's important to do.
Well, that creates an excellent segue for the next two folks who have signed up. Thank you very much, Mr. Warner. We've got Andrea Fogg and Juan O'Shell from League of Oregon Cities and the Association of Oregon Counties. You'll go ahead and identify yourselves for the record, and we are running very short of time, so you get 2 minutes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Andrea Fogg with the League of Oregon Cities. Pardon my handwriting, that is John O'Shell with the with the counties. I would first of all like to say that as far as local government is concerned, we appreciate Representative Ringo bringing this bill forward and the concept. We think it's very important that we have these partnership arrangements with the state and local government. When we originally testified on this bill in House Transportation, our comments were such that there are projects that are currently in the STIP. We think it would be a big problem if we had to take these funds out of existing dollars, because that would move projects that folks have been counting on for a long time. It puts a little bit different light on it if we're talking about new revenues. However, we still haven't found a specific link between this bill and new revenues. So if we were still talking about existing revenues, we could not support this concept. And even if we are talking about new revenues, we have some concerns in particular with how it would work with new revenues. Are we talking about House Bill 2142? If so, how specifically would it work, or with some other bills that are out there that would raise new revenues? We are also are concerned with some of the duplication process-wise. In particular, one of the criteria now within the STIP process is local match criteria that moves projects up in the queue, as well as potentially duplicating how projects are selected with another rules process. So those are some of the specifics with our concerns, but again, we think this is a good concept, and I'll turn it over to John. I think he's going to talk about some specifics with the amendments.
John Oshel, Association of Oregon Counties. Once again, counties very supportive of where this bill is trying to go. We very strongly support partnerships, recognize this is an attempt of another tool to do that. Basically details, and part of it has to do with, once again, making sure that this is tied to new revenue, which it's not yet, and if it can be, a lot of our problems go away. Would point out that if there's not new revenue, this is actually worse than where we are now. When you look at what happens, this $25 million that's proposed here isn't ODOT $25 million. This is state highway fund $25 million, which means 40% of that would be taken away from local governments. So in effect, you'd be pulling away from local governments all over the state to fund this program if this is being done with existing revenues. So once again, as you said, and we're getting, if we're talking new revenues, grand. If we're talking existing, we've got some real serious problems.
We're talking new revenues.
Okay.
Let's make that a baseline for this.
Baseline for this. Okay. And as we said, to tie this in with that, if it can be tied into the bonding package, to a certain extent, you know, once again, have the haves versus the have-nots, but, you know, if you're talking that we're going to set up a program with a different criteria of $25 million out of the $400 million program, we can see some reasonableness in that. That's one of the ways to try and experiment. If it's part of a big program, you can maybe set a different priority. Of course, you've got other people that are advocating that bill that have other priorities in there, and that has to be matched in. But, you know, we probably could live with that. We're concerned about a bunch of the details, a lot of which probably can be solved in the rulemaking. I think that's probably all I have, unless you have specific questions.
I just had one question I need to ask both of you, both Andrew and John. Do the cities and counties have any hope that House Bill 2142 will pass?
We're hopeful.
Yes, we're hopeful.
I think I read in both your magazines last night that
yeah.
You were
we're hopeful.
Ecstatic about it.
Do you
have those monies already expended?
No, we don't.
You don't have them?
No.
Which is another just quick point in the amendment. There's an April 1st date in this amendment that talks about when the projects would need to be selected. Consistency with House Bill 2142
right.
would be February 1st, those sorts of details, and thanks for the readership.
You bet. You're welcome. Thank you very much. Members of the committee, questions? These good folks from LLC and LLC, thank you very much. And finally, we have Randy Tucker from 1,000 Friends. Did you bring any of the other 999 with you, Randy?
4,999. Oh, shit. Actually, about 5,499. Anyway, it fluctuates. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to comment today on this bill. I will be brief, but I will say it's a pleasure to speak to a new committee this late in the session that I haven't spoken to. I'm speaking on behalf of my colleague, Jacob Brostoff, who's our transportation advocate. He's not here today. Mr. Chair, we haven't commented yet on House Bill 2142 in our newsletter, but you may see it at some point. So,
I read it from cover to cover.
Religiously,
man.
I'm sure. Much of what I would have to say has already been discussed this morning. Let me just point you in this written testimony, which, as you see, was originally delivered by Jacob back in March. And I've scribbled out the date and changed it as a hasty way of getting something into your hands. Let me point you to the third section here, the multiple project selection criteria section. This is, aside from the geographic equity issue that has already been discussed, our concern is that this bill seems to basically establish one criterion, the availability of local matching funds in order to decide about whether a project should be funded. The relationship to the STIP representative package has already mentioned that today, and we've been involved in a process, the STIP stakeholder process, which is going on right now through ODOT or the OTC, which we hope will result in a good, broad set of criteria for the selection and design of highway projects. And we would hope that To the extent that there is any particular priority given to matching, that it be just one consideration among many, our concern obviously has been the link between the selection and design of transportation projects and our broader land use and growth management goals. I'm not sure what Jacob meant in this written testimony where he talked about social policy. I won't get into that.
I circled that the social policy.
I was reading through in the back of the room going, I'm not going to touch that one. But at any rate, we certainly would like to... at any rate, Mr. Chair, we'd certainly encourage that this kind of a program be part of our larger project selection process rather than a separate sort of segregated or earmarked, if you will, fund for matching funds.
Thank
so in the current form, we can't support the bill.
All right. So you've heard from Mr. Tucker. Other questions? Representative Johnson.
Mr. Tucker, I don't want this to sound as though I'm trying to invite a fight. I'm just curious about your reaction. To what degree do you and those on the STIP committee that have been working with and following the STIP believe the STIP to have integrity in terms of actually laying out projects that there's a reasonable expectation will be built?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I'm not sure I can actually answer that because I'm personally not participating in that process. I know that, let me see if I can characterize what I understand my colleagues' views to be. I think my colleagues are concerned that there are a lot of projects that are on the STIP or that work their way through the STIP process that haven't undergone adequate scrutiny and that they've been there for a long time and they're sort of still there. In other contexts, and we're interested in the progress of House Bill 2142 as well, since I've been with Thousand Friends, we have been pushing to ensure that all of those projects in the STIP process be subjected to some enforceable and clear policy sideboards to ensure that only good projects that actually are going to solve transportation problems in a cost-effective way get funded. It's our concern that many projects that have been on the list for a long time don't necessarily meet those standards. So in the context of the other bill, the big transportation funding package, we've actually recommended some amendments to ensure that those projects comply with all of the policies that are contained in the Oregon Highway Plan, good policies we think are not always adhered to. And we're working with the department, and we'll work with the OTC and everybody else to make sure that happens. As far as whether those projects on the STIP are actually going to get funded, I don't really have a way to answer that question.
You've answered my question.
Okay.
Thank you very much. further questions, Mr. Tucker? Thank you, Mr. Tucker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm going to use the power and authority invested in me as the chair of a subcommittee. High and lofty position.
Should I be here to brace Representative Ringo?
Absolutely. To encourage both Andrea and John and Bruce to work directly with Representative Ringo to iron out any of the wrinkles. I guess I look at these kinds of things and I say, you got that great big wad of state highway money and the state highway fund, so let's just go ahead and tap into that, not recognizing that it hasn't already been divvied up between the cities and the counties. I wouldn't recognize that when I first saw it either. So I would like an opportunity to have you folks work with Representative Ringo on any of the concerns that he has, and I would encourage you to please, if you would, contact him directly so that you can set up appointments and begin to iron out some of those wrinkles, because I think this has a very inventive way to strive to do what Representative Johnson indicated, and that is to stretch those bucks. Going back to a movie that I enjoy watching with my kids, stretching that clothing dollar. So, with that, I will charge you with that, if you would, please, and we'll go from there. If there's no further business before this committee, we're going to go ahead and close the hearing on 3075 and the House starts in 20 seconds. Thank you.